Hello and welcome to the Center for International Maritime Security's Sea Control podcast. I'm Ashley O'Keefe, the Secretary of SIMSEC, and I'm here today with Dr. Tom Fedison of the U.S. Naval War College. He's been a member of the faculty here since 2000, and he serves as a senior advisor to the college's Russian Maritime Studies Institute. He received a PhD from the Johns Hopkins University in Political Science while he was on active duty. His 31-year naval career included military assignments as the U.S. Naval Attaché to Russia and two tours at NATO headquarters in Brussels, commanded the USS Normandy and the USS William V. Pratt, and deployed them to the Mediterranean, Baltic, and Norwegian seas. He was a principal contributor to both the Lehman-era maritime strategy and NATO's strategic concept following the Cold War. He's a nationally recognized expert and publishes regularly on maritime strategy, NATO strategy, and the Russian Navy, which is our topic today. Hello, Tom. Thank you so much for being here with us today.
Hi, Ashley. Happy to be here.
So let's start off our afternoon with a very basic question. Why is it that we should still be interested in the Russian Navy? I thought we were interested in China's rise these days.
Well, certainly most people in the U.S. Navy seem to care more about China's Navy than the Russian Navy. I can attest to that because I've been a Russian Navy guy for a long, long time, and I was the rough equivalent of the Maytag repairman for about 20 years. My phone never rang. I'm sure my China counterpart's phone was ringing regularly. World has changed. And let's just, kind of quickly take it to a couple of years ago when you're looking around the world and Russia, which had historically for about 20 years been that big former enemy who looked like it was going to be the next big cooperator or nation aligned with the West, becoming more and more like the West. And then we were shocked when in 2014, all of a sudden, Russia and the Crimea annexes the Crimea, starts a hybrid war in eastern Ukraine, and more or less gets everyone's attention. And so that same country that was cooperating with everyone back in 1998, even in 2005, is now listed in NATO documents, for example, as some combination of adversary and aggressor. So all of those military forces that they had, which looked like they were going to do nothing but have exercises with us, now are potentially aggressive forces that we, especially in the intel world, need to look at a lot harder.
So where does the Russian Navy operate today? Where are they? Are they in the same places as they used to be? Are they really a meaningful threat?
Yeah, that's a great question because those in the audience old enough remember the old Soviet Navy, and for a goodly number of years, maybe 15 or 20 years, they were effectively our equivalent, less that of carrier battle groups. In other words, they outnumbered us in terms of submarines. They were equivalent to us in major surface combatants. And every theater that we operated in, they operated in large numbers. Then they had about a 20-year period where they absolutely just went to sleep or almost in a coma. And so that's why we didn't hear about the Russian Navy for a long time. I'll make the case, and most experts on the Russian Navy will agree with me, that starting around 2008, the Russian Navy began to get money, they began to get smart, they began to get joint, and they began to operate again. So the answer to your question today is pretty much anywhere you can find ships of the Russian Navy. In some parts of the world, you can see a militarily significant force. In some areas, you'll only see them in onesies and twosies. But noting that 15 years ago, they were nowhere. There were none in the Atlantic. There were none in the Mediterranean. There were none almost anywhere. Whereas today, they're everywhere, even though they're not necessarily a military force to be reckoned with at the high level.
So Admiral Sir Philip Jones, who's the first Sea Lord of the British Navy, said a couple of days ago that they were seeing the highest level of Russian submarine activity in 25 years. And that's a sentiment that we've heard not just from the Brits, but also from the NATO commander last year. If that's true, what is so significant about that fact?
Well, going back to the, where was the Where was the turnaround? It was sometime after the year 2000. Now, I will only be speaking from unclassified sources, but it's been in the open press. A lot of these statistics have been in the open press, and I'll summarize them for you. Between 2001 and 2003, our best guess is that there were virtually no Russian submarines in the Atlantic. Realizing, of course, that was going to be where a good portion of World War III was fought. For them to have no submarines in the Atlantic is a very low standard against which to compare the First Sea Lord's number. But what we've been seeing is almost every year since 2008, there's been an increase in submarine activity of between 5 and 15%. And so right now, we're getting roughly 1,500 at-sea days for Russian submarines all around the world, but an increasingly higher percentage in the Atlantic. So, again, we did start from around zero, but we're looking at meaningful numbers again, certainly not at the level that we saw in the Cold War, but the trend is very clear, it's very upward, and it's pretty stark.
So, specifically, when we hear about submarines, we'll often hear about this GIUK gap. And for a generation that did not grow up in the Cold War, we don't know what that means. Can you talk to me a little bit about the significance of that phrase? And do we care about whatever that gap is?
You mentioned earlier the layman strategy, and believe me, we lived and died by the GIUK gap way back then. This is the Greenland-Iceland-UK gap. Just look at a map of the North Atlantic, and you can see that that's the rough equivalent of a choke point for any Russian submarine to get out into the Atlantic. It's got to run that gauntlet, and we did set up a veritable gauntlet there. We had all kinds of sonar, SOSUS activities. We had our own submarines up there, and we had probably the biggest maritime patrol aircraft base in the world up in Iceland set up with P-3s flying everywhere. And if you were a Russian submarine, you had to run that gauntlet. And the likelihood that some of our forces were going to find you and track you while you were making your Atlantic deployment is very, very good. This is essentially what we're up against now. We had about 20 years in which there was just nobody trying to run that gap, and now they're running that gap again, and we're seeing them again, or hearing them again.
So another thing that we didn't used to hear about is Russian aircraft carriers. Boy, so the Admiral Kuznetsov, we thought was going into a deep maintenance period, and instead she shows up off the coast of Syria. So how did she perform, and what did we learn from that deployment?
Now, first, let me make a little editorial about Russian aircraft carriers. Russians have been talking about building aircraft carriers for a long, long time, and it has effectively been talk. What we have seen loosely is that the Russians' ability to build very large ships is not very good, with the possible exception of submarines. Their performance in building large things that float has been maybe at about the D or D minus level. And of course, aircraft carriers are part of that category. So when you get a what we might call a sea control admiral in charge of the Russian Navy, invariably he will talk about building aircraft carriers. I don't think there's been a period of time where somebody in the Russian Navy wasn't talking about building aircraft carriers. But what did they deliver? Well, they've delivered for their operations right now one ski jump carrier with a very, very limited air wing. And, well, okay, we'll go into its performance in a minute. But do understand that it's a very high prestige ship in their Navy. I mean, it is far and away, you know, it's unique, and it does give a special capability to their Navy that no other ship brings. So Russian people are very proud of it. And much as in American politics, domestic politics matters to them too. And the fact is that the Russian press, which used to be reasonably free back when I lived there 20 years ago, is no longer free. It's very much controlled by the government, and it's simply a propaganda tool. And what you have now is an opportunity for the government to put a spin on aircraft carrier deployments which obviously make them look very, very good. And that is essentially what you had. You had two stories. When you had Kuznetsov deploying to basically the Syrian coast, if you were to only read the Russian press, and I always try to read the Russian press in Russian and in English, you'd be absolutely convinced it was the most successful deployment in the world. Noting, of course, that the air wing was roughly half of what it might have been and only a quarter of what we would consider a real air wing. So they went ahead and made their deployment. If you read the British press on any given day, all you'd see is a ship belching black smoke, and I shudder to say on some days it even looked like white smoke for all you surface warfare officers. Not good. And that's all you saw in the British press, other than the four British destroyers that were tailing it and having it in their sights the whole way. So was it successful? I'd say to the Russian people, absolutely A plus. To the Western world, not so much, maybe even C minus or D. And why? Well, the air wing that they took was minuscule, number one. Number two, they really don't have an opportunity to exercise their air wing. And I'm not a pilot off of an aircraft carrier, but I know this is very difficult. So I wasn't at all surprised to see them within their first week losing two airplanes simply because of an inability to operate a flight deck and an air wing properly. So when you only take over 20 or 25 airplanes and you lose two in the first wing in the first week, we shouldn't be surprised that effectively the entire air wing went ashore. Now, that probably wasn't anywhere in the Russian press, but it certainly was in the Western press. So did Russia end up with more airplanes in their Syrian operation? Yes. Did the Russian aircraft carrier carry them down there? Yes. Was it a successful carrier operation? I would say no, other than the fact that they brought some airplanes. And I don't think the Russian people know about this, but I do think it was fairly well reported in the Western press.
Super interesting. So given that lens, now my next question maybe seems a little silly, but what about this Project 23000E, the Storm, the next generation aircraft carrier? Defense News was reporting about it earlier this month. Maybe the Indian Navy is going to buy it. You know, there's a lot of interest there, too, in that we're working, the U.S. is working with the Indian Navy to some extent, or at least talking about it. So does this seem like a likely thing to be built? What are they going to keep trying?
Yeah, okay, I'll add a little editorial here, too. The Russian economy, I think everyone appreciates that the vast percentage of their income comes from exporting minerals, mostly oil and gas. Below that, it's arms exports. They export almost as many arms as we do. But they have such a small economy that their arms sales really matter. So when you look at Russian military activity, simply looking at military capability is just sometimes a small part of why they deploy. A larger part of why they deploy is to show off what technology they have and to try to sell it. Now, you mentioned the Indian Navy. When I was in Moscow, there were more Indian officers there than there was any other nation. The United States was second. Why? Because the Russians, you might say by the default of politics, ended up selling India its Navy. Still today, about 70% of the Indian Navy is Russian. I've spoken to a lot of Indian naval officers about this. Their sense is that they don't really like Russian ships. There's a lot of reasons that they don't work too well, that they're certainly suboptimal, but they can afford them. And the United States has this double whammy where we are not very good at selling high technology, number one. And number two, when we sell it, it costs a lot of money. And the Indian budget kind of makes them, forces them to buy Russian. And they continue to buy Russian. So should the Russians be able to build the Storm? Maybe India would be the most likely nation that would buy it. But remembering, of course, Russia just sold and delivered to them what they call the Vikramaditya, another ski jump carrier, which was 4 years overdue, 300% over budget. And every Russian naval, every Indian naval officer that I've spoke to said, well, it's not a good ship, but we needed an aircraft carrier and we could afford it, so we got what we got. Hmm. If this storm really turns out to be good, and they're talking nuclear power, the Indians may very well want it, but the Indians are also in the process of building their own nuclear-powered aircraft carrier, which would be their first choice. And if they can build it, and they're not very good at building ships either, unfortunately, they'll stick with their domestic product. Now, will the Russians actually build it? I would be very pessimistic. When they talk about Storm, they talk about building somewhere between 3 and 6. That's how definitive they are. They're not, you know, they can be off by a factor of 2 in terms of how many ships there'll be. And it seems that they're leaning in the direction of nuclear power, but sometimes you can read press articles that suggest maybe not. So they're so unsure of where this is going, and their track record of building big ships, that is, having the yards that can build a 65,000-ton ship, it's unlikely. In fact, it's probably more likely, if they ever get around to it, they'll probably have to build it in 2 sections and then weld it together. And I'm not a shipbuilder, but I know this can't be easy.
So let's switch gears a little bit off of shipbuilding and talk about their new maritime doctrine. So they released one in 2015. How did that change since the last one?
Their last one was in 2001, and I'm sorry that I'm a little bit nerdy and geeky about this, but I actually read these stupid documents. And they're not a good read. I tell my students, you know, they'll put you to sleep in a heartbeat, and it's important, though, to read them, because you need to know what changes there are from one document to the next. I mean, if you read American maritime strategy, it should be pretty obvious that the difference between the one that's just came out on the street versus the one in 2007 that are significant, and they will affect the way we operate and the ships we build. Same for the Russians. In 2001, they wrote what they called a maritime doctrine, and it was almost as if there wasn't a Navy admiral present at the drafting. It was like the Secretary of Commerce, the Secretary of Tourism, the Secretary of Economy, and the Secretary of Energy sat down and at the last minute invited an admiral to come in and to write a couple words. It clearly was a maritime doctrine, not a naval doctrine. In 2015, the new maritime doctrine is what they call it, was signed, first of all, by President Putin in a formal scene built for television aboard a brand-new frigate named after Admiral Gorshkov, as you'll recall, the founder, the father of the great Soviet Navy, in Kaliningrad Harbor, and the only other 4 people there was the admiral who ran Kaliningrad, the chief of the Russian Navy, the chief of Russian defense, and essentially Russia's national security advisor. The secretaries of commerce, energy, tourism weren't invited to this ceremony because the new document is significantly different. First of all, number one, there's a lot about the Navy for openers. The other guys get time too, but the Navy gets the most time. And when you read the Navy, the tone of the document is just wildly different. You will read phrases like, the Russian Navy's mission is to ensure that non-Russian naval ships are not allowed to operate freely in the Arctic. Things like, NATO is the principal threat to Russia. Therefore, the Russian Navy must deploy to the Atlantic because the NATO Navy must be hit, must be engaged before it gets to Russian shores. The Russian Navy will have a permanent flotilla in the Mediterranean. Remember, for a lot of years, there were virtually no Russian ships. When I deployed William V. Pratt there in 1989, we watched the 5th Escadra leave the Med. We were fully expecting that we would be doing the usual tricks with our Soviet counterparts, playing cat and mouse games with them, with their submarines, etc. They all left. And so the admiral called in all the skippers and said, we have nothing to do. Does anybody have any ideas? And my idea was 15 port visits. And he had nothing better, so we were able to have a love boat cruise. But, you know, obviously the world has changed. The Russians are back in the Med. They've got a flotilla there between 7 and 10 big, serious warships. And the reason that they're there, according to their maritime doctrine, is because of the NATO threat. So you read NATO threat all over this document. When you read in the Pacific, it's very, very clear, Pacific and Indian Ocean, they're all about establishing better relations with the Chinese Navy and with the Indian Navy. And so they call a spade a spade. They're not afraid to name names, who are the good guys and who are the bad guys. They're not afraid to talk about which fleets are growing. And by the way, every fleet is growing, according to this document. You wouldn't think it, but the Black Sea Fleet, which was supposed to simply go away because of Crimea and Ukraine, is now getting bolstered more than almost any other fleet. They're talking about expanding either to a great extent or to a smaller extent each of their fleets, having it growing quantitatively as well as growing quantitatively. And then finally, and I think very importantly, there was no discussion at all of shipbuilding in the last maritime doctrine. Huge chapter on shipbuilding this time. They have a consolidated shipbuilding organization, and it is tasked with building Navy ships in response to the demands of the Navy in terms of the missions that the Navy intends to do. And so in tone and in tenor and in content analysis, the words that you read in the 15 document are significantly different. And, you know, just the picture of Putin and the Chief of the Navy and the Chief of Defense sitting there in the wardroom of the frigate Gorshkov, I think, is worth 10,000 words by itself.
So let's pick apart a little bit this this modernization plan. So there's a strategy, and then there's also a modernization plan that is essentially inside of that strategy, as I understand it. So let's talk about the surface Navy first. How do they expect for it to evolve and modernize?
All right, well, they've got a plan, and I'll give you another editorial, too. Whatever they say, believe half of it, decremented by about 50%. And so they lie, cheat, and steal when they talk about how many ships they intend to, new ships that they intend to operate this year. When I look back on what they say and what they actually do, they get about half. Now, once again, it's one of these, how tall are the Russians? During the Cold War, the debate always used to be, you know, are they 10 feet tall? Are they 8 feet tall? How tall are they? You know, we ended up saying, you know, maybe 5'6". Today, we're sort of having that same debate. How tall are they? Nobody's saying 10 feet tall, and we'll get to that later. But for about 20 years, they were about 0 feet tall, where they built virtually nothing. The ships that they had, which was the second biggest navy in the world without a competitor back in 1989, they essentially just pulled the plug on it. And so the ships just were tied at the pier. They began to rot. Literally, they operated so few of them, it was crazy. And though quantitatively it was huge, qualitatively it was a mess. I can attest to that because I was attaché in the mid-90s, and probably a lot of the reports that I wrote on the Russian Navy at the time were laughed at when they were read in Washington because they were so horrifically bad. What you have right now when we talk about modernization is a couple of things. They went from building nothing, and when I say nothing, I mean just about nothing, to the point that they're building a few ships now. The few ships that they did build way back when were mostly aimed at arms export. So, yes, they sold, you know, submarines to Indonesia, to Vietnam, et cetera. They sold a lot of things to the Indian Navy. They sold a lot of things to the Chinese Navy. They kept very little. They kept onesies and twosies of every class that they built. What started to change in around 2008 was the fact that they continued to build ships, but increasingly to build them for themselves. And in the year 2000, of course, wasn't uncommon when they started to build, let's say, a frigate, to take them 14 years from the time that they laid the keel to the time they delivered it. You know, laughable, yes, but that was the way life was back then. I mean, understand, of course, Russia. Russia is a small economy. The reason that they lost the Cold War was because, not because they didn't have a fantastically huge military, it was because their economy couldn't keep up with our economy. So we outspent them to death, and they're very aware of that. Their economy still isn't very good. But what we had was that if you force them to build a lot of ships, they will run out of money fast. They knew that, therefore they didn't build many ships. Starting around, well, I don't know, 2005, 2007, economists can help us here, but when did the price of oil start to go up? As soon as it did, it was like, I mean, I hate to say this, you know, with scorn, but I mean, to a great extent, Russia is a large Nigeria. They're dependent upon the price of oil. And if the price of oil goes up, their wallets are very thick. Price of oil goes down, they're threadbare. And so price of oil went up. Oil was over $100 a barrel for a while, and they had more money than they knew what to do with. And they had a brand new Secretary of Defense back in 2008. His name was Serdyukov. Maybe we don't know him in the West, but in Russia, they really appreciate what this guy did. He not only demanded that a lot of money be spent on all the services, but the Navy got more than a fair share. Navy got almost 40% of this building budget. He did that, number one. Number two, he also kicked a lot of butt and took a lot of names with respect to the operational readiness of the fleet. He saw full well that the Russian Navy couldn't operate with the Russian Air Force or the Russian Army. Mm-hmm. Remember that back in the 1970s and the 1980s in the United States? That's what they started to grow out of. They became, under Serdyukov, they became more joint. He understood that they had a conscription-based military, and so many of their sailors were almost illiterate, and they clearly weren't the kinds of sailors that you and I would like on our ships. He started a policy that said if it goes to sea, and certainly if it's new construction, no conscripts. So the conscripts were left to be mess cooks at Navy bases. The real sailors, the contract sailors, went to the ships. So remember before I told you ships didn't go to sea very much in 2000 and 2002. They started to go to sea together more. So you had more ships at sea, more contract as opposed to conscript sailors. You got a qualitatively improved force. And at the same time, you were building ships that weren't just for arms export. You were also building ships for your Navy, and they went, I'm actually bragging here, so get over this, but it used to take them 14 years to build a frigate. Now they can build one in 5 or 6. Okay, that's not very fast, but they're getting better at it. They've consolidated their shipbuilding, and they're putting out a couple of ships a year. They announced that they're putting out 8 warships a year. I've yet to see the year where 8 brand new warships came out. But 3 and 4, yes. And of course, they're not big ships. They're smallish ships. And they might even be, you know, kind of enhanced patrol boats. But at least they are putting out ships. But there are meaningfully a few classes of ships and submarines that they are putting out that do appear to be successes.
So speaking about submarines, let's just maybe a brief overview of the submarine undersea forces and how do they stack up against today's U.S. submarines? Are they as good as they once were?
The answer is yes, but remembering, of course, that they were never as good as our submarines. But they got close, and they're getting close again to general areas. First of all, boomers, SSBNs. We maybe We have the luxury of having a blue water sea control Navy. They don't, and we can talk about that later. But first and foremost, their Navy is there for a strategic deterrence. And so when they get a dollar, they spend it on strategic deterrence first and foremost. Their most successful building program is what they call their Bore class, 955 class, SSBN. They've got three in the water already. They've got five more coming. And most Western analysts look at it as a successful building program. The bigger problem that they had was with their solid fuel missile that they're trying to mate to at the Bulava. That's had a very checkered past in which at times virtually every shot was a failure. Now they're getting about a 50% success rate. They're happy with that. They're mating the Bulava to the SSBN, and they've got three that they claim are ready to operate. Their deployments have been short. They tend to be sort of in the old bastion areas that we in the Cold War are used to looking at. But the point is that their SSBNs are going to sea again with an SLBM. And even though they did have a few other Delta Threes, Delta Fours, Typhoon, these were unreliable. It was rare that these ships would deploy. The Russians were proud to say that if necessary, they could fire a ballistic salvo from pierside, and that's true. But I'm just not sure that that's anything to brag about. Yes, they did have a submarine force with ballistic missiles. Now they have a few platforms with more to follow, and I expect them to be delivered on time, so that they will have a force of eight SSBMs, BNs, that can deploy and shoot missiles from sea. Now, SSNs, they've got a very impressive new submarine. It's large. It's got a lot of new weapon systems, and it's reputedly very quiet, at least in the unclass world. Looks to be close to but not quite an LA and Virginia class. It's carrying a lot of things. The problem with it is that it is so sophisticated by Russian standards that they're having a hard time following it with what they claim to be seven more of the Severodvinsk class. I think they'll happen, but they'll happen very slowly, and it'll almost be like custom-made cars. You know, they won't come off an assembly line because it's a little bit too difficult for them to put them on an assembly line yet. But they will be very, very good once they do come out, and they're now talking about a follow-on class of SSN with hypersonic cruise missiles and, again, more sophisticated gadgetry. But if I can summarize, their submarine building is way better than their big surface ship building program. That's where they've concentrated. That's where they put their talent. That's where they put their money. That's where they've had most of their successes. And that was true back in the Cold War, much as it is today.
Continuing our scope through things that the Russians might build, missiles. What does it mean that Russian corvettes were able to successfully launch caliber missiles out of the Caspian Sea last year?
Well, most of the cynics say, boy, won't a lot of people want to buy that missile? Because we're sure that the Russians are wanting to sell it, and they'll probably sell it a lot cheaper than the United States will. But the Russians couldn't get over how wonderful this was because they were able to shoot this caliber missile from two different directions on two different small platforms. The Buyan patrol boat, which is really, it's a 1,000-ton patrol boat, can carry eight of these cruise missiles with a range of 1,500 miles. Wow. Depending on what you read, but only three of them were misfires. 23 out of 26 hit something, presumably a target. And when we were first shooting our first cruise missiles, 30 years ago, we had probably a worse failure rate than that. They not only shot from the Buyans and the Caspian flotilla, but then they also shot from diesel submarines, their brand new improved Kilo class submarines, which are delivering to the Black Sea Fleet. They shot a salvo of them from the Med. So they had cruise missiles coming from both directions from unsophisticated, smallish ships, very sophisticated weapon. And the world took note of that.
It's really interesting. So I'm just going to kind of change gears here a little bit and go bigger picture. Talk about maritime power. Is it fair to call Russia a maritime nation? Most people, I think, probably would have called it a land power. How does that figure into Russia's national security image?
No, and that's right. It is mostly a land power, but it's a land power that knows how to use maritime power in selective and judicious ways. And I'm going to inject a little personality into this, too. But I think Vladimir Putin prides himself on his Navy. I think he identifies with his Navy. The Navy is sleek. It looks cool. It's got a quick punch. It's not the biggest guy on the block, but it can, you know, bloody your nose with a quick punch. He is a judo master, after all. He has used his Navy in a number of ways. Syria is the classic example, where not only does he have a force off the Syrian coast, but he is protecting the logistics with his flotilla. 99% of all the Russian logistics come from the Black Sea that goes to Syria through their port in Tartus, and it's defended by his naval forces. Obviously, they've delivered air power also. There's air defense that they've set up there. And what he has is an opportunity to play a weak hand and to play it forcefully. I mean, to some great extent, he played his Navy in the, as you'll recall, was it the 2013 Red Line issue in Syria and Chems, when that was when he deployed his force, first and foremost. And he was quick to point out that he had a naval force in the Med. We really didn't at the time. And that his naval force would watch and ensure that the Syrian chemical weapons got delivered to the appropriate place for destruction. So it's a small hand, but he plays it and isn't afraid to overplay it. He sends his ships. When we were discussing reestablishing relations with Cuba, he sent a cruiser into Havana Harbor, and it was sitting there while our diplomats were talking with the Cubans. So he does a lot with a little, and he's more than happy to identify with his Navy. There's really never a big Navy celebration that he doesn't put on his Navy hat. With the exception of going bare-chested, he is most likely seen in Google wearing Navy hats. He just seems to like his Navy. And he's been funding his Navy very well for quite some time. So I'm not going to go so far as to say it's a maritime nation because he doesn't have a sea control Navy. He has admirals that have been telling him to build a sea control Navy. But our Sixth Fleet commander did look at what he would be up against, and our Sixth Fleet commander wasn't afraid to acknowledge that, no, it's not a blue water Navy that can fight us in a fair fight. But yes, it isn't what we would call an A2 AD Navy that could do more than bloody our nose if we decide to get into a fight with them in the Eastern Med, in the Black Sea, in the Baltic Sea, and certainly in the Arctic. So it can do a number of things that can hurt us. They just don't have the sailors, the seamanship, the tradition, the Admiral Gorshkov to go after us again in the middle of the Atlantic or the middle of the Pacific. But near their shores, they're extremely potent.
So unbelievably, we have already reached 40 out of our 45 minutes. So I'd like to just give you an opportunity. Is there anything else you think our listeners really need to know, things we've missed in this conversation that you'd like to wrap up our discussion with?
Yeah, time does fly. But I guess sleep well at night. If it were a fair fight, our Navy still so wildly can outperform their Navy that they would never seek a fight like that. But as you see Russian doctrine talking about things like hybrid warfare, they're always interested in an unfair fight. And so they may very well want to take their hybrid warfare, their little green men equivalent, to sea, and may be interested in provoking us in ways that we have yet to predict, and we should be ready for that. This would not be existential, but it could certainly hurt us, and it could certainly hurt our pride, and it could certainly surprise us. So I would say let's be ready for that. But on the absolutely positive side, assuming, of course, you look at Russia as an adversary or as an aggressor, their military, much as the Soviet leaders before this batch, their military is dependent on their economy. Their economy has performed very poorly over the last couple of years, partly price of oil, partly Western sanctions. But the bottom line is they've had a negative GDP for a couple of years. What's happened under Mr. Putin is that his budgets have had to shrink in every area. If you were a provincial governor, you had your budget cut 50% last year. If you were a pensioner, your pension was cut 50% last year. If you were the chief of Navy, your budget wasn't cut. You're about the only guy whose budget wasn't cut. If their economy continues bad performance, I would argue the chief of Navy is going to get his budget cut next year. And all of the grand plans for the new destroyers, the new aircraft carriers, the new everythings will be put on hold, and it will be, once again, sometime in the future. Don't expect to see it in the near term.
Well, Professor, this has been a super interesting Sea Control podcast, and I just want to thank you for joining us. We really appreciate your time and insights, and hope to talk to you again soon.
Ashley, thank you very much. Super questions, and I time did fly. I had a great time.